This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 386 was produced on July 27th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Lynn Alden returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll take a deep dive on energy, talk about everything from crude oil to natural gas to shale depletion rates, and finally, uranium, before moving on to talk in depth about inflation. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, July 26, 2023. The S&P 500 futures were down 30 basis points, closing at 45.95. We'll take a closer look at that chart and those key technical levels to watch in the postgame segment. The U.S. dollar index up 75 basis points, closing at 101.03. The Dixie consolidating, but still in a primary downtrend. The September WTI crude oil is up 464 basis points, closing at 78.78. We'll take a look at that chart in the post game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. Gold down 55 basis points, closing at 1970, but continuing to crawl higher towards the 2000 round number resistance. Copper up 236 basis points to 390, testing the highs established over the past few months, and uranium up 45 basis points, closing at 56.10. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 12 basis points, closing at 387. Yields have been rising, but the key level to watch remains that 4% round number. The key news to watch this week is Friday's core PCE price index, and next week's there's still some key earnings announcements, as well as the ISM manufacturing and services PMIs, the Bank of England policy report, and the much-anticipated jobs numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Lynn Alden. Eric, why did we invite Lynn back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Lynn is a listener favorite. We're overdue to get her back on because it's been a long time since we had her. But mostly, I want an update on the energy market because she was really prescient. Her call when energy prices had just started to come off of their highs after the Ukraine invasion. She said, look, I think we're headed down to $70. It's going to bottom around there someplace. Then we're headed straight back up. Well, that's all played out. Is it time for it to head straight back up? I want to find out what Lynn has to say.
Eric's interview with Lynn Alden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lynn Alden, investment strategist founder, Lynn Alden. Lynn prepared a slide deck to accompany this week's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads above Lynn's picture. Lynn, it's been way too long. It's great to get you back on the show. I want to start just by looking at your slide deck. You're talking about valuations. Boy, it seems to me like something's going on that with breadth that seems unusual, and I haven't looked at it closely enough, but it just seems particularly AI stocks and some of these things are just to the moon. Well, it's creating, I think, an illusion that everybody thinks that the market is off to the races. It's not the whole market, is it?
First of all, thanks for having me back, Eric. Always happy to be here. And yeah, we're definitely seeing some big divergences in the equity market, both in terms of risk on and risk off, but also in terms of growth and value. And so, for example, on the first deck there, I show Apple versus CVS. And these are just kind of two examples of large cap stocks out there. The funny thing is that analysts' consensus forward earnings estimates are actually not that different between the two companies. They both had like a period of kind of 2-year earnings stagnation here. They both have kind of slow forward growth. Basically, they're both, at the end of the day, kind of value stocks. Like, they're not exactly fast growers. But we see Apple trading at well over 30 times earnings and has surged much higher this year. And all of it was valuation based. Whereas when you look at a lot of the, you know, kind of the either the cyclical value or even the defensive value, a lot of these companies are just trading at like high single digit price to earnings ratios, kind of completely left for dead, totally kind of uninterested by the market. And, you know, we can kind of go through sector by sector and see that some of them do have headwinds. For example, healthcare has been facing some regulatory headwinds, for example. But a lot of it is just, you know, basically there's so much risk on condition focused in the tech sector that a lot of other areas, especially defensive value like healthcare, has just been completely left for dead.
Lynn, I know something that you and I share in common is we both have a background in engineering and technology before we got involved in finance. So I particularly want to ask you about not just this divergence in general, but specifically with respect to artificial intelligence. It seems to me like we're having a repeat of the late 90s where everybody decided that dot-coms were the thing to buy. Nobody knew what they were. Nobody cared. They were just Wall Street guys getting on planes, going to San Francisco, buying up tech companies without knowing what they were buying. At least the way I'm perceiving this, I'm very curious to hear your take on it. Everybody's talking about the big AI stocks like NVIDIA. And so far as I can tell, most of the market participants that are buying NVIDIA because it's a big AI stock don't even realize that NVIDIA has absolutely nothing to do with AI. They make graphics cards. And it just happens to be a detail of technology, an oddity of technology, that just like cryptocurrency mining, the computers inside the graphics card are better for these generative AI applications to run on, and they work faster there. And so that's why they're using them. It's not like NVIDIA was the one to invent any of this artificial intelligence technology. I don't see any reason, if you think about Warren Buffett's idea of a moat around a company, I don't see anything NVIDIA is doing to, you know, protect its market share in AI. They don't know anything about AI. They're making graphics cards. But because graphics cards are the fastest way to run AI programs, a bunch of finance guys have convinced themselves that NVIDIA is driving AI, or at least it feels that way to me. How do you see this whole AI craze, and what do you make of it?
Well, so back in the dot-com bubble, kind of the you know, looking back on it decades later, what ended up being the case was that, you know, the big vision for how a lot of the internet companies would change our life ended up being true. But of course, the problem was that a lot of it was front-loaded in terms of valuation, and the market did, you know, had a very inconsistent job of sorting out which companies were ultimately going to take the market share. So you had ones that kind of, you know, blew up and crashed and never came back, and other ones like Amazon that blew up, crashed, and then, of course, had a very long growth story ahead of them. So I'm kind of viewing AI through a similar template in the sense that, you know, it's real. It's here. It's impactful. It's going to change how we interact with things in the next several years. And of course, AI is not new, but of course, when something hits a new threshold of quality and expense and is able to actually become economical, that's when it becomes relevant. And that's kind of the stage that AI seems to be at now. And, you know, the natural, I think, Wall Street reaction is to go for the picks and shovels play. So it's not that surprising that they bid up NVIDIA very hard. And, you know, I think that they're, over the next 10 years, they're going to sell a tremendous number of, you know, graphics cards. But right now, there's no margin of safety priced into that stock. And we have to remember that they rely on companies like Taiwan Semi to actually make the chips at the end of the day. And so I don't really view NVIDIA, especially after this massive run-up, as the place you want to be heavily concentrated. And instead, it's really, you know, there's a couple ways of looking at it. You know, one of the things I did early on was I leaned into a stock like Adobe, for example, because Adobe hadn't really run yet. It had already kind of corrected from the sugar high that we had a couple years ago. And some of the early theses around that would be that this would kind of just might disrupt a company like Adobe, whereas it started to become more and more clear that Adobe would probably absorb a lot of these technologies. They were already incorporating generative AI into their offering, and they weren't really at the kind of the very high valuation that NVIDIA was. But since I got into that one, I mean, that stock's just you know, kind of gone straight up too. And so I wouldn't really call that as having a ton of value left either. So I think a lot of the low-hanging fruit's already been run away with, and investors have to be very careful with what they invest in. And there's a couple ways of kind of going forward. One is that you can invest in the positive. Like you can say, what companies will be made better by AI? And you can also look at which companies likely won't get disrupted by AI, at least in any sort of like investable time horizon. So instead of necessarily trying to follow the trend, you can also just do a review of your portfolio companies and check which ones won't be disrupted. And that would get, I think, probably what we're going to talk about is place areas like energy and materials, kind of real world stuff that I think that AI is kind of nowhere close to impacting.
I want to come back to the AI question from a different angle now, because so far we've talked about it from, you know, where's the market opportunity? Do you buy NVIDIA? Do you not buy NVIDIA? Let's now talk about the impact to society of this very rapidly growing and rapidly accelerating generative AI technology. As a former technologist turned finance person, I'm very curious to get your take. If I sort of think there's a spectrum of what people think about AI ranging from, you know, let's say the zero is I think it's a fad. It's going to blow over. It's not important. One is it's going to change business. A lot of industries will be materially changed. Three is it's a threat. It's a risk. And let's say four is the outright, okay, the Terminator's coming. It's just a matter of time. This is going to be the end of humanity. On that scale, how do you assess what AI is going to mean to society?
Well, I think with every passing month, we get more data points. Right now, I'm in the middle where I view it as a very powerful tool that will make a lot of businesses more streamlined. So this is like, you know, a lot of what technology does is it makes things way cheaper, way more accessible, at least in the areas that it's able to impact. And so I expect that basically the cost of certain types of business overhead, the cost of certain types of legal overhead, the cost of production. I think basically, you know, right now we have all these different software packages, like different creator tools. They could be things like Adobe Photoshop, but they also could be various engineering design software. And as we incorporate AI into more and more of those things, it lowers the floor of skill to you know, get a workable usage out of it, right? So there's always going to be a case where more experienced operators of that software can make more of it. But by like obfuscating away a lot of the details of those tools, it makes those creator tools something that, you know, 5x people more will be able to use in the long run. So I think this unlocks a lot of like long-term economic value. I just think like anything else, it's going to be way blown out of proportion from time to time. And I think we're in one of those phases now. And I generally take the, you know, I think that it'll probably surprise the upside in terms of how it impacts us in terms of software. But I generally take the under on its ability to heavily impact us in the physical world. So the impact on robotics, the impact on energy usage, at least until there's certain kind of, you know, new physics breakthroughs or things like that, you know, kind of in this more investable time horizon, I don't really see it as super impactful for those more real world types of areas.
Lynn, let's move on to another subject near and dear to my heart, which is energy. You say on the second slide here, energy is under-owned. Well, I own as much as I can afford. I guess other people don't see it yet. What's going on here?
So I think across the spectrum, whether you go for the underlying commodity or the equities that are associated with it, energy's kind of been left for dead. And that kind of falls in line with what I was talking about before with the Apple versus, you know, CVS comparison or the tech versus healthcare. Energy is another one of those areas. This time it's more cyclical value rather than defensive value. But it's an area where even during the big price spike of oil last year, a lot of the equities never really got over, like, excited about it. Neither their stock prices really soared, nor did their management teams kind of take those prices as though they were going to stay. And so you saw very conservative behavior both by investors and by management. So investors were careful not to bid the prices up too high, and management used a lot of the, you know, kind of the windfall profits they got from that period to pay down debt, pay dividends, do buybacks, maintain their drilling rather than put it all back into the ground. And so we're in a situation where energy's corrected pretty significantly, but we've not really had any sort of large CapEx cycle. When you look around at the supply side, we're still rather tight. And so I still view long-term the full energy complex as generally under-owned and an area that investors should be looking at with, say, a 3 to 5 year view. You know, if you're looking around the market, you're concerned with, say, you know, the valuations of the top 7 stocks, you're concerned about the valuations of the NASDAQ as a whole. When you look at it, certain other types of the market, I think there's areas like healthcare, there's areas like energy, there's certain select emerging markets like Brazil or India that are interesting, but there are other pockets, I think, of value compared to what you can get in those big tech stocks.
Well, I definitely agree with you on the bullish outlook for energy. Needless to say, it's much easier to make that fundamental call than it is to time the market, but you've actually been pretty darn good at timing the market, because when I interviewed you shortly after the Ukraine invasion peak in energy prices, you were very much on top of the market. You said, look, we've had that peak, we're headed down, we got a ways to go, could get to $70. You nailed that call. And then you said, we're headed back up as we get that reckoning with the reality that supply just, you know, doesn't have a lot of room to grow here. I couldn't agree more. Do you think that the rally we're seeing now is the beginning of the big move, or is it maybe still another economic weakness print that's going to scare the market back down to test those lows?
So the short answer is I'm not sure, but I think this, the fact that there's been some of a rally and a recovery is really worth watching. I think it's a genuine one. And a lot of people in their mind, when they think of recession, they assume oil has to crash. And that's because the past two recessions we've gone through have been pretty unusual in that regard. One of them was obviously the COVID lockdown. Another one, the Great Recession of 2008-2009 was one of the biggest recessions on record. And it also had happened after a better part of a decade of a lot of CapEx, a lot of new energy supply coming online throughout the 2000s decade. And so the recency bias says, okay, if we have to have a recession, that means, you know, get out of energy. Whereas we look at other recessions, like say the post-dot-com bubble recession, oil often just chops along through them. In fact, when you look at the past, you know, say 50, 60 years of total energy usage, it's only gone down worldwide 5 years. And three of them were in the early 80s. One of them was 2009, and one of them was 2020. Many recessions, global energy usage still goes up. You know, I do think that the economic weakness that the market's in right now has played a role in keeping prices down. And I do think that there is still significant risk of a recession late this year, early next year. And so I'm not necessarily expecting, you know, oil prices to start going vertical right away. But I do think that my approach with this whole kind of my long-term energy outlook is to not really overthink it. I think the supply and demand looks a very strong position. And I'm not going to assume that there's going to be some big, you know, downward crash. And so I'm long in the industry. I'm willing to kind of like lean more in should we get further periods of weakness. But the further you look out, this supply and demand situation is very favorable.
Let's move on to page 4 on your deck, shale dynamics. I was particularly interested just to look at the rig count chart. We saw that really nice sustained recovery in the rig count. That's the on the left side of the chart, that's the purple line. From the end of the pandemic, we saw that really solid recovery in the rig count. Okay, U.S. shale patch, going back to work. Wait a minute, looks like it peaked. What's going on there? Is that the beginning of a change? Is there a fundamental driver behind that peak?
Yeah, so on this chart, about 7 months ago, it shows that U.S. rig count peaked. And it's been a little while since I made this chart, so it's actually about 8 months now, I believe. And when we look back at the prior two, generally there's an 8 to 15 month lead time between drilling activity and between, you know, the top in overall U.S. production. And so, you know, if this is, you know, if we're kind of watching activity, we should expect that in the months to follow, unless we were to see some sort of turnaround, that U.S. oil production is probably going to peak at a similar level as it did before. I think a lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been drawn from shale, and now it's no longer this kind of big new source of energy production for the world. That's where the majority of growth was, and now that's kind of tapped out. And so, you know, a lot of this goes back to the point where I said before that a lot of these energy companies were conservative. Instead of, you know, aggressively taking their incoming cash flows and just piling it back into new production and assuming that this spike was going to be sustained, they kind of treated that whole oil price spike as transitory and said, no, we're going to focus on responsibility. We're going to focus on balance sheet improvements. And so a lot of them, you know, they did what they had to do to maintain or mildly grow their production, but they didn't splurge like they did in prior cycles. And so, yeah, about 8 months ago, drilling activity started to roll over. Pricing wasn't exactly sending the signal to put a lot of money into the ground. And so I think in the coming months, we're going to start paying for that, which is that our production is going to start topping out.
Lynn, I took you down that path on the rig count because it fascinates me, but I should probably back up to what you wanted to tell us a little bit more broadly about this shale dynamics. What else should people understand about shale oil and where it fits into this story?
Well, an overall factor is that shale oil is quicker to bring online, and it also depletes quicker, which means you have to constantly put money back into it in order to sustain the production levels that you're getting. And so this recovery that we've seen, this kind of post-COVID recovery, it was kind of the low-hanging fruit in the sense that, you know, they started the rig count back up again. They tapped into a lot of their drilled but uncompleted wells. So in some sense, we could think of it as kind of like drawing down existing inventory if we were to make an analogy to another industry. And so they've been able to get a decent amount of production back online, almost back to the prior peak. But, you know, I think a lot of people, if they're not focusing on some of the details of the industry, they assume that this is just fully sustainable, that we're just going to, you know, kind of keep increasing our total production levels. Whereas when you look at actually what's happening under the surface, some of the rate of change stuff, or where a lot of this new production has been coming from, it's not exactly signaling that the type of production growth we've seen over the past couple of years is going to continue. And that, of course, has all sorts of implications for price. And so when we zoom out and think about the total supply and demand situation, you know, the slower growth out of China, the sluggish economy here in the US and over in Europe, these things are all around the margins, loosening demand to some extent, but the supply side still remains tight. So the SPR was drawn down aggressively, and that's, you know, it's not turning back up yet, but that speed of drawdown is certainly behind us. We also had, you know, China help Iran get more of their oil to market. And so that's been like a source of supply. But when you look around further, most of the marginal supply now is global. And there's not exactly a lot of it out there. And so I think basically we're still in a structurally bullish energy environment until there's some sort of significant amount of CapEx.
Lynn, I want to put this in perspective with respect to the history of shale oil and how we got here, and then get your commentary on it. I know you're already aware of this history, but I want to share it with any of our listeners who may not be familiar. Almost 20 years ago, there were a whole bunch of really smart people who had a hypothesis called peak oil, and they predicted that a lot of really, really bad things would happen to the global economy as we were unable to produce enough oil to keep the world running. They were dead wrong, but they were not as dead wrong as everybody in finance seems to think they were. A lot of people think, oh, that peak oil theory got disproven. Nonsense. It was not disproven. What happened is, all around the world, just like the peak oilers predicted was going to happen, oil production went down, and it went down substantially, and it's going down in exactly the way the peak oilers predicted it was going to go down, in the sense that it cannot be increased within those oil fields without finding new productive resources someplace. What happened that the peak oil crowd didn't anticipate was the U.S. shale revolution, which made up for that. We went from 5 million barrels a day to 13 million barrels a day in the United States as the rest of the world went down by the same amount. Well, guess what? The rest of the world is still declining because that is inherently the nature of how petroleum fields work. As you pump oil out of them, the reservoir pressure goes down. They don't produce as much oil next year as they did last year. They're all in a state of decline. And now what you've just told us, Lynn, is the shale oil boom, which was the salvation. That's the only reason the peak oilers didn't get proven right back in 2007 and 8. You're saying it's ending, and I agree with you. That means there's some pretty significant consequences coming our way. Do you agree? And if so, how big are those consequences? And if not, what am I missing?
So I agree with you. When we think about like longer term, the challenge is that people have a tendency to underestimate human ingenuity. And so when they're analyzing how much, you know, oil production is going to happen, it's not always possible to think of the full range of future technologies that are available to us. And so the shale revolution was really born by a combination of, you know, technologies that were maturing, but also very low cost of capital. And so going forward, now that cost of capital are higher, and now that a lot of the low-hanging fruit in shale has been already tapped into, I do think that basically structurally, some of the easy growth, some of the offsets we've had to the decline in conventional oil, is that offset's not going to be there anymore. And so I try to avoid making giant predictions like, oh, we've seen the all-time top in global oil production, because I don't know what's going to happen with the Arctic or with, big new discoveries and things like that. But I will also go far as to say that basically without a significant CapEx cycle, it is going to be increasingly hard to get meaningfully new oil production. And yeah, that could certainly expand into a much longer kind of permanent high watermark for how much oil we can get in any given unit of time. And so I think that basically this is at least a multi-year story. And then, once we see what happens there, once we see a period of higher sustained prices, once we see more aggressive exploration activities, we can reassess what does the field look like at that point.
Lynn, let's move on to natural gas and specifically a trade that Adam Rosenzweig told us about. And I'm sure you remember that particular interview. Adam said, hey, look, we've got a really great convergence trade opportunity, which is natural gas in Europe costs way more than it costs in the United States. The reason is because we're able to produce more of it in the United States. And right now we're still building the infrastructure. We haven't yet fully built the infrastructure to export all of that natural gas as liquefied natural gas, but that's rapidly being developed. So the trade that has been suggested is long U.S. natural gas against short European natural gas, not talking about the front month contracts, but long dated contracts to arbitrage that eventual convergence. Seems to me like a brilliant idea, but boy, it's been a brilliant idea for a long time, and the trade is not paying off yet. What do you make of this? Is there a trade there, and why hasn't it worked yet? And when do you think it's going to start working?
So I think that's a long-term position to be aware of. A lot of these LNG export facilities take years to build. And of course, natural gas compared to oil and many other commodities, that transportation is a much larger and more complex part of it. So natural gas is less geographically fungible than you get with oil or other types of commodities. And so as you pointed out, and as others have fully discussed, there's that big price differential, not just between Europe and American gas, but also Japanese and American gas. And so over time, as we get more and more U.S. export infrastructure, assuming we don't have any sort of like protectionist policies that cut the producers off from making use of that, then we should see over time that convergence trade. Now, the timing is going to depend partially on weather. I mean, that's part of the reason why natural gas is so explosive to the upside or downside, is it can be, it's very seasonal, very weather-based, very kind of locked in by these transportation challenges. And so, I view that less as like a 6-month trade and more as like a trend to be aware of when you're trying to, for example, if you're looking at U.S. companies with significant gas production and you're trying to model out their forward long-term kind of the range of outcomes, I generally would err to the upside in terms of what some of these North American gas producers might be able to do, because I do expect eventually for that price differential to somewhat narrow. And so, longer term, this is like another piece of the story, I think, to be aware of. And of course, another way to play that is with less risk is some of these midstream companies that care more about volumes and care less about price. And so, there were periods in the past where some of these midstream companies were pretty expensive, whereas right now, a lot of them are priced for basically zero growth. And so you can get basically high single digit distribution. You can get then low single digit growth. Some of them are even buying back their own units, which is historically unusual. And so there's multiple ways to play it. But I think that the kind of the big themes here are there's not a lot of easy new supply like there was last decade. Cost of capital is now higher. And we should see more and more infrastructure and therefore more convergence between, U.S. and foreign LNG.
Lynn, since we're on energy, let's move on to another market that you and I have both begun following in the last year or two, which is uranium. Let's start with the just really big picture. You started watching the uranium market as I've started watching the uranium market. How are you thinking about nuclear energy? Are you just thinking about it as there may be a trade opportunity there right now? Or are you thinking, okay, there's going to be a big renaissance and we're going to replace oil with nuclear over the next 30 years? What's your big view and where is the trading opportunity?
So I've been long uranium since autumn of 2020, and it's something that I've not tried to time it too specifically, but it's something that I just keep as a background structural trade until the conditions for it are done, and they're not yet. And so basically, we have a similar problem there as we have with oil, in the sense that right now, there's just not a lot of new supply coming to market. If you look at the market now, basically, we consume more than we reproduce on a global basis. And so we're constantly tapping into older secondary stockpiles. There's some opaqueness there. No market participant can say for sure exactly how much secondary supply there is. Of course, different analysts will come up with different estimates. And so longer term, even with just a slow rate of growth or even just a flat holding of the reactors that we already have, the long-term case should be fairly bullish, especially when you're comparing it to other assets out there that you can own. Basically, if you just hold underlying uranium, the risk-reward, I think, is pretty attractive. Now, if we do start to get to some of the scenarios you talked about earlier, like if we have increasingly a tougher time increasing our global oil output, while we still have ongoing growth from, you know, low oil, you know, capita consumption places like India and other highly populated countries that are, you know, they just like the rest of us, they want to consume more energy per capita. They want to develop more. They want to have more material comforts. And as that demand continues, I think there's going to be a constant lookout for all types of different energy sources. And I think and I hope that we have more of a, I don't know if we'll get a full-on nuclear renaissance, but I do hope that the period of stagnation that we've been in at least starts to turn back up to the upside. And, you know, I think there's a number of new technologies that can help out with that. But I also think that, you know, kind of necessity becomes the mother of, you know, either invention or in this case, adoption, which is that, you know, people get sick of having energy crises and they look around and say, well, here's an energy source that you know, meet some of our standards and is been underused. So I think it's certainly an area that I'm still long.
Lynn, let's move on to base metals. I've been watching copper with great interest. I'm kind of hoping that we get this recession everybody's waiting for so I can buy the dip in copper. And I think it's going to be a fabulous trade for the next several years. But I also think that it's vulnerable to the economic situation that we have right now. How do you look at the copper market? Where do you see it headed?
So I view it similarly. I've been a little bit less optimistic on it than I have with energy. With energy, I've been willing to kind of just stick with, even with a potential recession call. Whereas copper, I've been a little bit more careful to try to kind of wait for the cyclical timing to be a little bit more attractive. And so far, the price has held up a little bit better than I would have guessed. And so I don't really view it as a bad position here. You know, I think basically until we have another period of renewed growth. So let's say, for example, the purchasing managers and indices for many of the markets around the world, until they start turning back up, I think copper is going to continue to be probably range bound. But then once you do start get that upturn, I think much like energy, copper is like a multi-year story where we've underinvested. It's not easy to bring new supply to market. And then there's all sorts of environmental restrictions. Like, you know, for example, people will say, we don't want oil and gas. We want battery metals. And then they also will say, oh, but you know, mining is bad for the environment, so you can't mine them. And so we kind of get into this gridlock position where it's very costly, time consuming, and, you know, always uncertain whether or not new projects are going to come on in a workable time frame. So I think the long term case is still very bullish there. But I think the trigger you want to probably look for is some signs that leading economic indicators are turning back up rather than kind of still in this malaise that they've been in.
You mentioned battery metals. I'm particularly curious about what you think cyclically about where we are in the timing of that story. The way I'm looking at this is, you know, there was kind of a battery metal craze for a while as people saw energy transition and electrical vehicle revolution. They were smart enough to connect the dots and say, okay, this requires a huge amount of copper. And then they said, okay, it requires a huge amount of battery metals. And that led to a craze in this. It feels like that's kind of wearing off now. And I wonder if we're at the calm at the end of the first initial, you know, fascination, where maybe this is the dip we want to buy.
So I think that's a good way of thinking of it. I've generally, for that whole space, I view copper as the cleanest risk reward. That's kind of like the one where it's no matter what technology ends up, because things change over time. They're getting more and more efficient at using less and less battery metals for, a given amount of energy storage and things like that. But copper is the universal that's there in all of these different things. And it's both battery metals. And then it's also, I think a lot of things that, especially finance people miss is how much grid updates you need if you want to electrify things more, right? So they kind of assume that if you just buy more electric cars, that's what solves the problem. But basically, if we talk about a wholesale shift towards more and more, battery storage and electric cars and things like that, you're basically saying this whole, gasoline transportation system we have built up, all that energy distribution has to basically go over electrical wires now. Basically, we would add that on to what we're already doing. And I don't really think that transition is going to happen anytime soon, but it's clearly around the margins. That's the pressure. That's like the demand pressure that's out there. And so whether it's the electrical grid, whether it's battery metals and things like that, I think that's the part that's still somewhat underowned. And I try to avoid all these big areas of fads or price spikes. And so I've been pretty cautious around not jumping directly into the battery metals. And instead, I've been more in like the copper side and more in like these other types of ways to play it with less risk.
Lynn, I wanted to start by talking about the fundamentals on energy because it leads into the next conversation I want to have, which is inflation. I think the most important thing to figure out is, are we at the beginning of a new secular inflation, or was this big bit of inflation that we've just seen just transitory because it was the aftershock, if you will, from the pandemic? I think that's the biggest question to answer. Seems to me like what energy prices do next is going to be the biggest determinant of what inflation does next. What do you think? Is the bottoming that you're perceiving in energy and other commodities maybe a sign that inflation is persistent, or how are you looking at this?
So if you look back at prior periods of inflation in developed markets, normally it does come in waves. So normally you don't just get one inflation spike. Normally you get multiple inflation spikes because you have periods of time where central banks are fighting back, or in some cases government officials are fighting back with price and wage controls, depending on the era. And so it never really goes up in a straight line. And when it comes back down, that doesn't necessarily mean that the whole situation is behind us. And so going back to my prior point, basically, until we see an energy capex cycle, I would be concerned about further rounds of inflation. And whether that wave starts roughly now, or whether that wave has to go through another 6+ months of kind of economic malaise before it starts, that's still, I think, an open question. But I do think that the risk still lies for an upside surprise in inflation when we look ahead to, say, 2024, 2025. We'll see how the timing goes. But basically, the way I kind of think about it, we had the rising PMI and then the falling PMI. My concern is that because the fundamental drivers have not been fixed, the next time we have a rising PMI, or basically broadly some degree of economic acceleration, I do think it's a pretty likelihood of coming with a side of inflation again, because the underlying problems aren't there. And one way of thinking about it too, in addition to energy, is the fiscal side. And so when people think of inflation, they often think of the 70s, and that was very much lending-driven inflation. So we had demographics. The baby boomers were entering their home buying years year after year after year, so they were taking out a lot of credit. You had a lot of bank lending inflation. Then, of course, you add to it the Vietnam War and the oil embargoes. That was a very inflationary time. Whereas the 1940s, virtually all the inflation was fiscal-driven. So banks were not lending almost at all, and most of the inflation was driven by very large fiscal deficits. And as we look forward now and into the future here in the 2020s, we have this larger backdrop of just larger structural fiscal deficits. And it's not as stimulative as things like stimulus checks or childcare tax credits, because it's not kind of filtering in from the bottom up, but it still is this background kind of slower burning stimulatory effect or potentially stagflationary effect. And so I think the combination of structural fiscal deficits as well as a tightness in the energy markets is probably going to give us, again, next time we have a period of economic acceleration, I would be surprised if that did not come with another round of significantly above target inflation.
Lynn, let's tie all of these ideas we've talked about today together into what investors actually care about, which is portfolio construction. How do we bring all of these ideas you've talked about? What do you actually buy in your portfolio to benefit from all this?
So I think the first thing, obviously, we have to do is determine what kind of market participant we are. I mean, a trader is going to use this type of information differently than a investor. Generally, no matter if you're an investor or a trader, I think it's helpful to know some of the fundamental tailwinds so that you know which direction to err in when it comes to a given asset class. But because I'm on the longer term side of the spectrum in terms of like investment time horizon, I tend to look at what's going to do well over, say, a 3 to 5 year period while still trying to be cyclically aware. And so I'm kind of going with a three-pillar portfolio at the current time, which is basically, you know, one pillar is profitable, reasonably priced equities, including some of the ones I showed in this presentation. But just broadly, if I look around and I find profitable equities, I still generally view them as decent places to hold capital long-term. Then also, I add a significant commodity slash inflation protection part of the portfolio. And that's still what I think is under-owned in most portfolios. So if you think of a classic 60-40 portfolio, it's very much geared towards disinflation. So it benefits from bond yields going down. That allows equity valuations to structurally go higher. And if we do enter a period of, you know, waves of inflation or on average above target inflation, especially if it's more energy driven, one of the ways to hedge all of your other otherwise disinflationary positions is to have some of that direct exposure. So it could be commodity producers, it could be underlying commodities, it could be hard monies like gold or Bitcoin. That kind of assortment is how I think of that whole part of the portfolio. And then lastly, I still think there's a space for cash equivalents, T-bills, because, you know, I think most of the signs still suggest that we're not out of the woods yet in terms of recession risk. I know the Fed meeting today, basically the Fed's now saying that they don't really see the recession risk that they saw before. But I still think that, you know, when we look at a broad range of leading economic indicators, I still think that we're kind of, you do want to basically be prepared for that choppiness for the next 6 to 12 months. That I think that basically you want to have some disinflation protection in your portfolio, even if you're otherwise structurally thinking inflation long term. And so I've been using those kind of three portfolio different kind of sides of it that I rebalance over time to kind of lean into whatever I think's, you know, underowned at the moment.
We're recording on Wednesday afternoon, so the Fed data's only been out for a couple of hours. But already what I'm seeing just in Twitter traffic and other notes, emails and so forth coming across my desk is this continuing belief that, okay, what this means, what it's all about is there could maybe be one more 25 basis point hike this year, but it's impossible for any more than that. And I don't understand, Lynn, why everybody, there's this consensus idea that the Fed has to stop hiking just because they almost completely collapsed the banking system as a result of their hiking. I'm not sure that that's going to stop them, and I don't know why everybody is convinced that it will. What do you think? Is it really true that the most hawkish possibility is just one more hike this year?
Well, I think we have to consider both speed of the hikes and the final level. And so it is true that they have a certain speed limit that if they, you know, they go too far too fast, they break things. That's what we saw back in the springtime. Whereas if they inch up very slowly, they have more kind of leeway there to get higher. And you know, I think we're finding out that the market is not very interest rate sensitive. So when you look at, say, the U.S. market, homeowners mostly have 30-year fixed rate mortgages. That's not the case for many other countries in the world. So when you look at a spectrum of how much household debt to GDP different countries have, and then what percentage that is fixed rate, American households are relatively protected against that ongoing, you know, kind of rate hikes. The same thing is true for a lot of, say, blue chip corporations. A lot of them use this opportunity to lower their interest rates and extend their duration so that now that, you know, even though interest rates are much higher, a lot of them are locked in for many years. Like, for example, Enterprise Products Partners, that pipeline stock I showed on one of the slides here, their average debt duration is 20 years. And so even as interest rates increase over time, it's going to put relatively little pressure on them. And instead, most of the interest rate pressure is on, you know, very specific areas of the market, commercial real estate, unprofitable tech stocks that are reliant on high valuations and constantly issuing new equity. Those types of areas are vulnerable here. But otherwise profitable entities that have locked in fixed rate debt are more resilient to what the Fed's doing. And we can even get to a point where, because this is mostly fiscal driven inflation rather than bank lending driven inflation, that makes it somewhat stickier against the prospect of rate hikes, because the whole premise of rate hikes and the whole premise of all that is to try to slow down bank lending. But if bank lending was not the key driver of inflation, basically what they're doing then is they're offsetting the real source of inflation, which was fiscal driven inflation and certain supply side limitations, by saying, well, because that all was too high, we're going to try to slow down bank lending. The problem is if that background fiscal ongoing deficit is still there, you know, if you can slow down bank lending enough to cause a recession, but then when you want to get out of that recession and you want to, you know, allow more lending to happen again, those key inflation drivers are still there. So I don't try to predict exactly how high they're going to get, but we are seeing that aside from certain pockets, the economy is not as rate sensitive as many of us might have thought. And I think the long-term trend is still towards, you know, periods of either stagflation or renewed periods of inflation.
Well, Lynn, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Lynn Alden Investment Strategy.
So, lynnalden.com. I provide investment research. Some of it's free material. Other parts of it are low-cost paid subscriptions for subscribers, both retail and institutional investors. And I've been working on a book on monetary history called Broken Money, so people can check that out in a month or so as well.
And that will be on Amazon?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, you'll have to let us know when the book is actually released, and we'll get you back for a book review interview.
Thank you.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great to have Lynn back on the show. Loved her focus on commodities, which I think is an asset class to watch. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Lynn's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a drawdown of 600,000 barrels on crude oil inventory. Didn't pilfer anything more out of the SPR. That's 2 weeks in a row of no drawdowns out of the SPR. Hopefully, we'll continue on that streak. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 2.6 million barrels. That's another big drawdown there. Gasoline drawing down 786,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 245,000 barrels. U.S. production ticking down 100,000 barrels to 12.2 million barrels. Tape action, well, the rally was already in progress before the data. After the data, it kind of stumbled. We'll see what happens. Right now, the 55-week moving average at 79, spot 97, is co-located with round number resistance at $80. So are we going to get above $80? That's what's holding us back right now? I think probably so, but I wouldn't be surprised if we go back and retest the breakout zone. That's the 200-day continuation moving average, just around $77. So I think maybe a dip down to 77 before this continues. Now, the thing that could completely corrupt this rally is if we get new macro data that suggests, okay, the recession really is still coming, and we are going to see the stock market collapse, and the blow-off top that Darius Dale predicted in the stock market, and everything turns around and it's all to the downside. We could easily get back to new lows if that happened. But for now, it looks like the rally has legs.
Yeah, on page two, we have that chart on crude oil, and I have that 200-day moving average that we were highlighting last week. You can see we definitively broke out above that 200-day moving average, though I don't think that this is just all upside on oil. Not that there isn't a new bull trend potentially underway, but typically as we approach previous highs and after such a clean run higher, typically the rallies are checked, and so I wouldn't be surprised at some point here if we saw something anywhere from a $2 to $5 pullback in crude. But so long as the bulls defend it and buy dips and get it back up to the highs in a reasonable period of time, that will continue to support the idea that there's a new bull trend forming. And then we could talk about crude oil returning back to fourth quarter of last year levels, which was around the 90s. And so it's certainly the first time in a while that crude oil's behaving half decently. Let's see whether this turns into a new bull trend. Now let's move on to equities here. Eric, what are you looking at?
My chart shows R1 resistance at 46.12, and so far that's been what's holding the rally down. As I've said several times in recent weeks, the trend is up, the trend is strong, and the trend makes absolutely no sense to me personally. John Hussman, who called the 2000 and 2008 bubbles, also says this trend doesn't make sense to him. He says it would take a full 64% down from here in order to set up a return to historically normal valuations, a buy-the-dip opportunity, so to speak. So according to John Hussman, surely an abrupt change of direction is imminent. Well, okay, as much as I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Hussman and side with the bears on the fundamentals, the fact is that the market doesn't see it that way, or at least it hasn't seen it that way yet. If that reversal is imminent, we haven't seen the signs. I'll believe it when I see it. Right now, the trend is up.
Well, let's get into the different levels here. Nick, I know you're watching the S&P 500, and what levels are the options markets showing you?
Spot price right now is 45.65. We have an implied move for the August 18th OPEX of 100 points. So the upper expected move is 46.65, and the lower expected move is 44.65. Right now, the call wall is right above at 4,600, and we have a put wall below at key support of 4,500. Next levels of support are at 4,350 and 4,300. Right now, I'm thinking that if we break that call wall area at 4,600, we get a blow off top to around 4,650, 4,670 perhaps, before a slight pullback. What are your thoughts here, Patrick?
Well, you know, to me, there is obviously the March of 2022 high that we're directly testing here in the post-FOMC. Clearly, what Powell was saying was not a surprise to the market and certainly not at least initially a catalyst for a market reversal. Here in the post-ECB period, the market continues higher. And so to me, the path of least resistance remains higher. Now, while we are quite overbought, and inevitably this rally will get checked with some sort of a correction, it's clear, at least initially, that the first wave of earnings and central banks are not the catalyst for that turn. And so at this moment, the magnet has to be its 2021 highs in that 47 to 4800 area. While, like I was saying earlier, I think that there's going to be a deep mean reversion of this rally once we have some sort of a blow off top. But at this stage, it doesn't look like anything is stopping this from tacking on an extra 100 plus S&P points. But we'll certainly see whether that momentum follows through. What's interesting, though, Nick, is that the NASDAQ has not broken yet to a higher high like the S&P has from its previous week. What are you watching for on the queues?
So interesting you mentioned that, because right now the call wall is at 400, just above where we're at right now. The spot price is about 380 on QQQ. The implied move for the August 18th OPEX is plus minus 13 points. So the upper expected move would be 393 and the lower expected move would be 367. So right now, looking at that call wall at 400, just above that is all-time highs at 408, 409 on Qs. It's possible we push that level, as obviously if we break higher, it's not very far away. So if we do get that blow off top, it's possible we see that all-time high tested, maybe even broken perhaps. But again, I am more bearish on big tech in the longer term. Midterm, hard to say. I prefer to play the small caps in the form of the Russell instead.
You know, I think the interesting thing to watch will be whether or not we see some sort of sector rotation in the post-earnings period. Obviously, Apple and Amazon and a few of the other big ones are still up in terms of their earnings next week. But will we see a scenario where the S&P, because of a broad rally in a lot of the sectors that lagged, continues higher, but we see that there's a lot of rotation out of the tech tech into in diversifying out into a lot of the more cheaper assets out there. It's certainly the thing to watch. One of the interesting things, though, that we're seeing here in the post-FOMC here, Nick, is volatility pretty much right back down to year lows. I mean, we're seeing the VIX now under 13, down in that 12 handle, just volatility, at least on the 30-day VIX, which is looking at the implieds going into the remainder of the summer, are very, very low. What's your thinking here on vol?
Yeah, Patrick. So right now, with the VIX at around 13, the expected moves each day are about 0.7% roughly in broad markets. And as we've seen in the past, these lower levels often are met with violent rises due to some catalyst event. That catalyst event remains to be seen what it actually is. But again, selling premium right now, especially on the put side, is more risky, I would say. And it's probably smart to be more cautious as we rise in markets, because again, the asymmetry of risk gets worse and worse as we go higher, and likewise as the VIX goes lower. Now on page 7 here, we have the US dollar index. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
Well, we saw the breakdown below the bottom of the consolidation range. Then we got the predictable rally back up to retest the breakdown zone, this time testing it as resistance rather than support. Check, that all happened. Now the question is whether that level holds as resistance, in which case we could be at the beginning of a really big move down on the dollar, or it could be that that was a false breakdown and we're about to rally up into the high end of that prior consolidation range. Both of those scenarios are still possible. The jury is still out, but I'm leaning toward the former. A couple more sessions and we'll know where the next leg is headed.
Well, Eric, it's interesting here whether or not the dollar remains down here below 102. All of those key lows at the through the first and second quarters of the year established a support that was broken. And if the dollar here remains in this downtrend and we see breakdowns maybe down to 98 or even lower, that can spell obviously weakness for the dollar, but it would certainly be a bullish tailwind for a number of the different cross assets that tend to benefit from U.S. dollar weakness. Will be really interesting to see as we, you know, have a couple trading sessions after all the monetary policy releases, whether or not that U.S. dollar downtrend continues.
And moving on to page 8, we have the gold futures chart. What are you guys thinking here?
Well, since I have a big long position on, it's nice to see the market looking like the bottom may already be in for this correction at 1900. But the reason I'm still skeptical is I think the Fed is likely to prove more hawkish on rates than the market is expecting. Just a couple more surprise hawkish rate hikes could shake the confidence out of this gold market and put us right back in the middle of the 1800s. But that hasn't happened yet, and until it does, this chart's looking pretty bullish to me.
Yeah, what I wanted to do here was just zoom out on this chart. And I wanted to really capture almost 5 years of data on here. And it really shows that 2020 and 2022 high of gold that was tested again this year, just over 2000. So overall, gold has held very close to its all-time highs. And this 2000 level, in my mind, is a nice, clean, round number to watch. If for whatever reason, gold is given that push above that 2000 level, it will draw some money flow. And that's going to be a real interesting moment to see whether or not this is the period from which gold can make that press to all-time new highs. That's a little bit early, but overall, the pattern of higher highs, higher lows, and the trend toward its highs remains there. So the question is what catalyst will emerge to potentially drive flows and cause gold to make that move. It's certainly something that I'm going to keep an eye out on there. What I wanted to wrap up with is I know Lynn talked about uranium, and what I want just have here is that Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. This is the one that trades in on the TSX, and we see it upticked a little bit. It obviously had a little bit of a deeper pullback than the U308 contract was trading at a bit of a discount, but it's turning up, and most uranium stocks actually continue to be well accumulated and in a good clean trend. It'll be interesting to see whether or not this Sprott Physical Trust can get back toward the 17.5-18 level that were the highs of this year, and whether or not it sets up for a retest of that $20 level in the coming weeks and months. And one way or another, the chart generally continues to look very bullish. Finally, on page 10, I wanted to just talk about this Invesco Agricultural Fund ETF, DBA. And while a lot of the grains like wheat and corn remain muddled, obviously off of their lows, other key components of this, like coffee and cocoa and sugar futures, continue to actually do very well. And we see this pushing toward its 52-week high. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not this entire commodity basket can actually push to all-time new highs. It'll be certainly something that would start being talked about if it was underway.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, Lynn's slide deck, and the chart books that we discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a number of articles that we found interesting, so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.